again, and welcome to Musings on Golf, where we are delivering some great stories about U.S. Open pasts and getting you ready for the 123rd U.S. Open Championship this week at L.A. Country Club's North Course. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my great friend Bob Bupka. Bob, happy U.S. Open week 2023.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. U.S. Open, for all of us that live in the United States, it's the biggest event on the calendar. If you don't live in the United States and you're a real golf nut, I assume a lot of people would take the position that the Open Championship is the ultimate. But this week, we're celebrating golf in the United States at the Los Angeles Country Club. And what a gem of a golf course this really is.
Yeah, first time it's ever been held at the North Course at LACC, as it's affectionately known. Mike Wan, the CEO of the United States Golf Association, is our guest a little later today. And you're going to hear from Mike some interesting things about this particular setup with wider fairways, something you don't often hear, if at all, about the U.S. Open. But a variety of different kinds of holes, different setups, has the makings, Bob, for a very special week.
Well, when you say variety of holes, how about just the par threes? They got one that could play just about 300 yards, and they have another one that'll play, if they wanted to, at 78 yards. So that's variety, my friend.
Well, it sure is. And you mentioned about the pride that we here in the United States have for the United States Open. What unbelievable passion our good friends north of the border in Canada had last week during what was an unprecedented week in golf, with everything that happened with the major news early in the week, to have it climaxed by a fellow countryman, Nick Taylor, becoming the first Canadian to win the Canadian Open since 1954. Pat Fletcher did so back then. Capped off, Bob, in a four-hole playoff over Tommy Fleetwood, 72-foot putt that sent the country ablaze in the best possible way. And here's what Nick Taylor had to say after his glorious moment.
My confidence probably has never been this high, especially the last 3 days of the shots I was hitting consistently, the rhythm that I had out there, and I was seeing the lines really well. There's a lot of luck for that to go in the hole. The speed is all I was looking about. Tommy probably had about 12 feet, and I expected him to make it almost like the first playoff hole, so I was trying to get as close as I could to essentially know that he had to make or miss to keep going. So for that to drop was a huge surprise, but an amazing one.
It sure was amazing, Kelly. I can only think what Tommy Fleetwood was saying to himself, standing there watching that 72-foot putt go in. And it really gives precedence to the much-used saying in golf, especially when you're playing match play, always expect your opponent to hole out his next shot. That way you're not going to be surprised. Well, 72 feet. I guarantee you, Tommy Fleetwood was surprised.
He was, and he handled it. I've always liked Tommy Fleetwood a lot. He handled it with a lot of dignity, a lot of class. He has yet to win still in North America, and I know he desperately wants that. I expect him to play well this week at LACC. But heartiest of congratulations to Nick Taylor. And then, of all things, Adam Hadwin. He gets tackled, Bob. Starting to spray some champagne for his fellow Canadian winning, and down goes Hadwin. Down goes Hadwin.
That was quite a tackle. I think that security guard was auditioning for the Canadian Football League. I mean, yeah. He did not recognize Hadwin.
No.
He was doing his job, but I guarantee you he had to be the most embarrassed guy in all of Canada that Sunday, moments after that putt.
Yeah, and it was. He's fine though, and he'll be great going forward. What a funny little sidebar to the end of it, Bob. It wasn't a funny week though, in all. I mean, let's be honest. It was and continues to be, even from some of the early press conferences I'm seeing and hearing at the U.S. Open. I think players are still confused as to what all this means, where it's going, etc. I know this: when the Saudis made a commitment to golf, for whatever reason they did, it changed the playing field completely. And when that happened and they started throwing around millions of dollars to get guys signed with him to create this kind of goofy 54-hole exhibition, if you will, with outrageous purses, that forced the hand of the PGA Tour. And then the PGA Tour, they took them to court, and that's forced their hands in a lot of big ways financially. I live not too far from Seminole Golf Club here in Jupiter, Florida, and Jimmy Dunn, whose name has popped up quite a bit as really the man who got all this done. No one is more respected, certainly at Seminole and in many ways throughout the golfing world in terms of a behind-the-scenes individual. Jimmy Dunn lost many of his people from his company on September 11th when he was actually out playing in a qualifier for the U.S. Mid-Amateur on September 11th. I think that he did what he felt was in the best interest of the PGA Tour and looked at the long-term potential of an outrageous amount of money that the tour was going to have to reach into because of what the Saudis had started. And like it or not, they're in bed with the Saudis going forward. I guess the feeling for him and the tour, Bob, has to be better this way than the tour collapsing at some point.
Well, you're right about that. And I've been thinking about this just about 24/7. And I either dreamed this or heard this or whatnot. But I think in retrospect, the best possible thing that Jay Monahan could have done with that meeting that he called of the players, he simply could have made the following statement. Boys, you're going to have to let me cut the purses or we're going to have to merge with LIV. And I guarantee you, if he handled it that way, 99% of the tour pros in there probably would have said, well, let's not cut the purses.
Because it goes back to what you said initially when we talked last week. It's what drives the world in so many ways, and that's money. And the amount of money that was out there that that is now going to be available, I think. And I think you'll see much more of a global tour with, as far as the PGA Tour is concerned, and with very high purses. Yeah, I think ultimately the guys will be happy. And it's just a different approach, a different way of thinking. And I got to tell you what, Bob, here in Washington, being a Washington football fan, the NFL, whatever they choose to be called these days, the guy who's looking to purchase the team is struggling to get he's got about 15 or 16 others they've cobbled together the money for a $6.1 billion asking price. There aren't that many individuals that have the kind of money to buy sports teams with their value. The Saudis at some point, it may be next year, it may be 5 years from now, they're going to buy an NFL team, they're going to buy an NBA team, and then they're really going to make inroads in the U.S. market.
Well, I'm sure more than one of our listeners is saying, well, how are they going to be able to do that? What kind of money are we talking about here? Well, let me give you a couple of numbers. They have $720 billion, yep. $720 billion in their war chest right now. And that comes from oil. And then they did a survey to find out, well, how long is this oil going to last? It could run out. They'd be out of money. Well, the oil right now is going to last for 220 years. So the money's there now. The oil's not going to stop coming. And what you predicting could very well come true.
Okay, so let's switch to the U.S. Open. Hey, you've covered a lot of U.S. Opens. Does anyone particularly stand out for who won that year or a moment in time? Is there a favorite U.S. Open story you have?
Well, there's an incredible story, and it goes back to 1981. USGA wanted to host a U.S. Open at Shinnecock. 1896 was the last one that they held there. So Frank Hannigan was assigned in 81 to go out and make a presentation to the members of Shinnecock as far as hosting a U.S. Open. Well, as the meeting was winding down, the members said, give us a couple of minutes. They retreated. They met. They came back, and they said, we're too small. We're really not interested. We don't have that kind of membership for volunteers. Frank Hannigan then said, on his own, what if we rent Shinnecock? And the members of Shinnecock said, what? He said, we'll rent it. The USGA will rent it. We'll pay you $5 million. We'll run the entire thing. Lo and behold, that's the format that came into play. If you want to do it under those terms, yeah, we're fine with it. And that led, shortly thereafter, every U.S. Open, the USGA rents the host course. Yep. And that has meant millions and millions and millions of dollars to the United States Golf Association just on Frank Hannigan on his own saying, we'll rent it.
And it is a business model that the PGA of America certainly has followed with the PGA Championship. I believe starting about that same time, Bob, it's a business model that has helped sustain the United States Golf Association and the PGA of America, and has built those purses and made those championships, you know, the highly viable ones that they are among the four top ones in the game. That's a great story. I love the U.S. Open like you do. And David Fay, former CEO or executive director of the United States Golf Association, once referred to it as the most democratic championship in golf, where you have these two stages of qualifying for those who aren't exempt. And a great example this year is Barry Henson, 43-year-old Uber driver who qualified for his first U.S. Open. Who knows, Bob? Maybe he becomes the Michael Block of the U.S. Open as an amateur. By the way, Michael Block came up a little bit short in trying to get into the U.S. Open. But the stories, the human interest stories that we touched on with Mike Wan, that's a big part of what makes the U.S. Open open and so special.
It really does. And your words were beautifully put together. And, you know, the U.S. Open is the U.S. Open. Yeah. And, boy, it's going to be an exciting week because this is a brand new test for the United States Golf Association. George Thomas, I think, is the guy that that designed this golf course. He also designed Riviera. You know what he charged to design Riviera and Los Angeles Country Club? Absolutely nothing. He didn't get paid for his designs. He actually was much more interested in developing roses. He's credited with putting together 1,200 different species of roses, which is really his love. But his design here at the Los Angeles Country Club, anybody that's lucky enough to be going there, you're going to enjoy it, and having to watch it on television, you're going to see something very, very special right in the heart of Los Angeles.
Yeah, very much so. And before we get to our picks, one of the defining characteristics of the North Course at LACC is the Barranca, which Mike Wan references. Barranca is a steep-sided ravine, a gully or a gorge of varying width and depth. It's common among a lot of the landscape in Southern California and prevalent, Bob, throughout the entirety of the North Course at LA Country Club. So it's a very different look than viewers are used to seeing in championship golf.
Absolutely, and the players are going to have to adjust.
Yeah.
The fairways are wide, but here's a little tip for our listeners. The fairways are very wide. However, they're very sloped. So you almost have to work your ball against the slope to keep it in the fairway. If you hit it going with the slope, you are going to end up in some pretty nasty rough.
Yeah, you are. So let's get to our picks. You're coming off a great call with Brooks Koepka winning the PGA Championship at Oak Hill. For me, it's a tough one to bet against him. I don't know that I necessarily have a long shot, but I'm going to go with Scottie Scheffler. He played so well at the Memorial a couple weeks ago. He just did not putt well. He teed to green, was off the charts. I just like to think he's going to figure it out. And I see Scottie Scheffler prevailing over, I think, what I think will be a very, very strong leaderboard when it's all said and done. And again, I'd like to, not a long shot, but I'll include Justin Rose in there as someone who should threaten.
Well, congratulations, Kelly Elbin. You now have successfully made a correct prediction written down on my sheet, none other than Scottie Scheffler to win. And a little wrinkle, though. I think if Scheffler doesn't get it done, I think it's the guy that got robbed last week, none other than Tommy Fleetwood. He played brilliant at Shinnecock. Yeah. He's on the top of his game. He has yet to win in the United States. But he's a great guy with a great personality and a magnificent golf game. If Scheffler doesn't get the job done, watch out for Tommy Fleetwood.
The beautiful flowing locks and all. So Mr. Bupka and I both take Scottie Scheffler. Hope you all enjoy the U.S. Open. And right after this, from our friends at Titleist, you'll hear from USGA CEO Mike Wan.
The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X are designed to outperform. Created in Titleist R&D laboratories, manufactured in Titleist golf ball plants, and then validated by the best players in the world. These golf balls are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with the new Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Kelly Elbin along with Bob Bupka and Robert. We are delighted to be joined by the man who oversees the day-to-day activities at the United States Golf Association. He was the commissioner of the LPGA for more than 11 years before taking the job at the USGA in July of 2021. And this week, he is in Los Angeles for the playing of the 123rd U.S. Open at the North Course at LA Country Club. Mike Wan, welcome to Musings on Golf.
Thank you. Glad to be asked.
Hey, Mike. Bob Bupka here. Thanks. Let me add my thanks to you taking this time out on an incredibly busy week. Bring us up to speed. Is the golf course ready? Are you happy with the conditions as we approach the first peg going into the ground?
Yeah, the golf course is a 10 out of 10. I mean, I really... huge thank you to the members of LACC. I mean, they've been playing on their own little AstroTurf mats for about 4 months, you know, so they all carry around this like 2-inch by 12-inch, you know, wherever your ball lands, you put it on your mat and you hit it again. Been no carts on the course. I mean, you'd work pretty hard to find a ball mark or a divot in this place right now. It's really perfect. And I think for your listeners and your viewers, they're going to be surprised when they turn on the TV and see this U.S. Open. LACC is wide. It's I think our average fairway width is like 46, 47 yards, and we have some that's wide as 70 yards. We're going to play LACC the way it was designed, the way the members play it. It's going to be firm, it's going to be fast, and it's probably going to be longer than most members played it. But our philosophy is to go to the greatest cathedrals in the game and then let the players play the cathedrals as they were designed. Maybe I have a slightly different philosophy, but as I told my team, I don't want to see 200 trucks of fescue roll into any one of these. If we're going to go to the greatest venues that America has to offer, we'll make them tough. We'll make them challenging. You know, we'll certainly get the players' attention. But let's let these golf courses be played the way the architect envisioned it. And so you're going to see LACC the way you'd see it if you were playing it. And it's and I think people are going to be blown away with what a spectacular setting it is and what an incredible I'd call it plus minus golf course. You'll play one hole that's reachable par four, and the next hole will be a 280 yard par three. So it's it takes and it gives away.
Let me ask you this, Mike: is there a signature hole or a couple of holes that are the viewers of your U.S. Open can hope to see?
I think people will probably remember the par threes at LACC. They're incredibly different and a lot of variety. You're going to see a par three this week that plays, I don't know, 88 yards. And you'll probably see a par three that plays 299 yards. And so obviously you got elevation and different things, but I mean, you're going to, and I would say by explaining that to you, Bob, I'm kind of explaining LACC. You know, you're going to see a 535 yard par four and a 320-yard par four. And George C. Thomas' original vision was to give you some holes that you could go for it and give you some holes where you got to buckle up. And I would say the busiest person this week at LACC will be whoever is the standard bearer carrying the scores behind the players, because they're going to be reaching into their pocket and changing scores almost every hole. We'll see some two unders, but it might be because you had six birdies and four bogeys. It's not going to be because you had just this huge series of pars. And that's where I think people will see a difference at LACC versus than what you might have seen in the past.
We're thrilled to be joined by Mike Wan, the CEO of the United States Golf Association. Hey, Mike, second time in 3 years that the U.S. Open heads back to Southern California, or head to California. But next month, the U.S. Women's Open goes to Pebble for the very first time ever. And I would imagine, certainly based on your tenure at the LPGA, this must feel, to take this event to such an iconic venue, really elevates women's golf.
Yeah, you know, I was the commissioner of the LPGA when this deal was done. With Pebble Beach and Heidi Uberoff and Mike Davis. And I remember Mike calling me, and I had a player meeting, I think, two nights later. So I was at a player meeting. He said, listen, it's not announced yet, but let me tell you where you're going to be in 2023. And I think it was Carrie Webb who came up to me later and said, 2023, you're going to make me now play until 2023, because there's no way I'm missing Pebble. It's really incredible, the venues that you know, when the LPGA, especially when they think about their majors. I mean, I was just at Baltusrol the other day because it's close and I'm a member there and it's close to my home, and to see KPMG and their build, and then to know that from there their next major will be at Pebble. It's iconic. Everybody knows history out there, and it's so great to put a women's U.S. Open in the mix of all of that history. So it's going to be an exciting time. I'm definitely padding my frequent flyer points this year between LACC. We have a women's amateur at Bel Air, you know, heading out to Pebble. So I'm getting to see the country from 40,000 feet an awful lot this summer.
Hey, Mike, I want to ask you a little bit just in terms of your background, certainly from a business standpoint, having worked at Procter & Gamble, you oversaw a hockey company, also working at TaylorMade and Wilson Sporting Goods. Did all of that help you prepare for all the different elements that went into being commissioner of the LPGA in a way that, had you just had one particular job, you know, may not have given you that variety?
You know, it's funny, when I got the offer to be the LPGA commissioner, I said to, there was a board committee, there was probably 15 people sitting across me in a hotel in New York, and they said, we think you're the right candidate for the next commissioner. I said, I'm not sure you're right. I mean, why do you think that? Because I have more concerns. And I remember one of the people on the board said, well, where would you be really? Because I said, I'm not sure I'm comfortable. I haven't run a tour. I haven't, you know, sold media rights around the world. I don't set up golf courses. I'm not a TV expert. So what's the attraction? And the board member said, well, where would you add value? And I said, well, one thing I could tell you is I've been a sponsor of everything under the sun, from TaylorMade to Adidas to Procter & Gamble to Wilson Sporting Goods. I've sponsored every golf thing in the world. So I've sat on the other side of the chair. I've written checks to tours like yours, but I've never actually asked somebody to write a check to me. And the board people all kind of mumbled back, and they said, that's exactly what we don't have at the LPGA. We don't have the understanding what it's like to be a customer. And we need to build that as a cultural element into our. So in a strange way, as I got there, I realized pretty quickly that what I could bring was the understanding. So we had this thing called role reversal at the LPGA, which meant any meeting we were in, the first 50% had to be talking about the person that was writing the check about whatever topic we were in. So if we're going to talk about the CME Group Tour Championship, first 50% of the meeting had to talk about CME and why they were doing it, what's important to them, what are their objectives. And then after that, we can talk about hole locations and pin placements and where we're going to put the, you know, volunteer tent. But since they don't care about any of that stuff, you got to make sure that the first part of your meeting is about the stuff they really care about. And I think that mindset shift was beneficial for the brand, because I think we became one of the most customer friendly entities in the world.
Yeah, and you really saw it from a different perspective. That's fabulous. You know, we had Seth Waugh on during the week of the PGA Championship, and Seth, you know, has been on board at the PGA of America a little bit longer than you have been at the USGA. But, you know, got Seth's perspective of what he had learned in that period of time, what he maybe didn't know before. What have been some of the things about the United States Golf Association that you've learned, if you will, since taking over the job? And where do you feel like you've started to make a difference?
I think the big learning for me was just breadth of impact. I mean, as a guy who had grown up around the game, I've, like, as you pointed out, I've worked on tours, I've worked on manufacturing side. I felt like I understood the USGA. I knew USGA executives pretty well throughout my tenure. David Fay was a board member of the LPGA at the time when I got this offer. So I really felt like I understood the USGA. But if you would have asked me what's the USGA, I would have said rules and championships. And even in championships, I would have probably rattled off three or four. But when I got there, it's 15 national championships, boys, girls, men, women, pro, pro amateur teams, non-teams, adaptive with disabled. So quite a world of championships, really, to make sure that, you know, best players on the planet have something to really strive for, no matter where they are in their journey. But I'm really floored by all the rest. I mean, I call it Unify, Showcase, Govern, Advance, but the unification of the game, course ratings, World Handicapping System, GIN app. It's really a significant thing when you think about the fact that you and I could get off the plane in Thailand, hop in with another twosome, and there could be a 16-year-old girl and an 84-year-old guy, and we could actually pull out our GIN app, compare handicaps, and play on a course that's rated and our handicap. And, you know, try that in baseball or soccer. You know, it's really an amazing game that really pulls people together. I was floored that, you know, we test 5,000 pieces of equipment a day, and I was excited by the level of involvement the USGA has on the real future of the game. It really is an entity that spends most of its time thinking about golf for the next generation. I mean, there's a lot of entities in this game, and I was one of them. And in fact, I've been a few of them. Generally, they think about either their membership or their shareholder every day. I mean, it's about today. The USGA and the RNA, it's really about tomorrow. It's really about making sure that our kids' kids inherit a game better than we had than when we were kids. And it's an important role. I feel a responsibility to make sure that I'm investing, I'm strategically aligning, and that I'm making sure that whenever my tenure ends, that I can comfortably say that we left golf in a better place, not just today, but more importantly for the future, because it's difficult for some of the heads of these other entities to spend a ton of their time on the future because they've got membership they have to deliver to today.
Mike, you used the word future. I must say the white elephant in the room is getting so big I'm being squeezed. Can you give us your take on what's going on in the world of professional golf right now?
I wish I was more educated than you, Bob, but you know, I was as surprised as the rest. I feel like there's an awful lot that we all still have to learn. That must be known, but you know, hasn't been shared just yet. So I'm going to kind of wait and see where this nets out. I'd be shocked if the outcome of this isn't that the PGA Tour and the current PGA Tour board is not still in majority control of both tours and investments and how they're going to grow the game. And anything less than that would really be surprising to me. But at this point, I don't have a better handle than you do. So I feel like I've spent the last, you know, 4 or 5 days of my life only talking about that. And given, you know, 10,200 people tried to make it into this U.S. Open, I've tried hard not to be another headline, because I feel like this championship and 123 years of history, you know, deserves the headline for a few days.
Very well said, Mike. And the next time I hear of a political position that's open, I'm going to give you a call and say, Mike, I think you're the man for the job.
I'm not sure that's right for me, but I appreciate you thinking of it.
Hey, Mike, to that point about the record number of entrants into the U.S. Open this year, man, Mike, golf's longest day, and what you've done in partnering with Golf Channel and all the human interest stories that came out of play a week ago Monday, man, it's some riveting stuff, Mike, from coast to coast. It was a really cool day.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you know, we were talking about, you know, handicapping and that stuff, but if you think about it, where else could you, if you're a good football player, you don't have an opportunity to, you know, to go somewhere, show up, and if you can really throw well for the next couple of days, you could be in the Super Bowl. But that's what the U.S. Open is, you know, 10,187 entries. We had entries from every 50 state. We had entries from 87 countries. So it's definitely our national championship, but it's got a global invite list. And then, you know, getting down to final qualifying, we had, I think about 880 people went through some stage of final qualifying. And then that final longest day, 650 people planned for 45 spots. So, I mean, that is the ultimate theater. And the fact is, you know, you're going to see, you know, Stuart Sink getting in next to a current Uber driver. I mean, it's just you don't see that in any other sport. And so the stories are so over the top. My wife came home from a meeting on Monday night, and I was tearing up on the couch, and she says, "What's wrong?" I mean, she thought we had like family crisis. And I said, "These stories are killing me. Like, you know, it's amazing You know, it's amazing the challenge to get in there. So there's a reason why at the U.S. Open, we actually pay everybody who gets in the field, even if you miss the cut. I know a lot of championships, you know, you miss the cut, you miss the cash. But you get paid at the U.S. Open, even if you miss the cut, because in our mind, making the cut at the U.S. Open is getting in the field. If you're 156 out of a starting point of 10,200, you've earned your spot. Now, there's obviously better money and better notoriety if you're playing on the weekends. But, you know, making the cut at the U.S. Open is weeding your way through 10,200 to get a tee time on Thursday.
Yeah. And Mike, you go to Pinehurst next year, and that begins three times at Pinehurst over the those 11 years after that. What was the strategic sense direction in terms of having that anchor site at Pinehurst? Why?
Yeah, so I would not just say Pinehurst, but whether you're talking about Pinehurst, Pebble, Oakmont, Marion, I mean, these are all places we've made really longer term commitments to. And here's the simple thing. I don't think, you know, many people get this, but it, you know, it's just a fact, is typically for 100 years, the U.S. Open goes and plays somewhere, and we go play in Oakmont. And 3 months after we play and everything's torn back down, we go in for a debrief meeting. And you talk about all the things. If we had to do it over again, we would have paved that area. We would have made these changes. We would have moved, you know, volunteer tenting over there. And we all say, great, you know, high five. And then about 12 or 13 years later, we all get together again, usually new staff on both organizations. And you start over, and you've done none of the things you talked about. Wouldn't it be great to? Because who's going to invest a bunch of money if you didn't know you were going to host more U.S. Open? So now, by sitting down with Pinehurst and saying, hey, you know, we're going to be here, not just with the U.S. Open, but with a lot of championships over the next 25 years. What should we do together? What should we, the state of North Carolina, the town, the village of Pinehurst, what should the owners of Pinehurst and the USGA get behind to really make sure that we can supercharge these championships, make it better for the players, the caddies, the fans, the viewers? We've never really been able to do that. I watch, you know, I've got good friends at Augusta, and I watch every year they get to kind of debrief, and then they fix something. They make something a little better. So the ability for us to say to the state of Pennsylvania, or the city of Pittsburgh, hey, we're coming back to Oakmont, and we're coming back regularly. And more important, to be able to say to those members, you know, we're coming, you know, there's going to be financial opportunity for you. And as a result, let's invest some of that financial opportunity into a much better championship. So I think you'll see the dividends of this pay off over the next few decades, because we've never enabled clubs to know we were coming. And as a result of knowing we were coming and knowing that opportunity was coming, to make significant, you know, every time we played at Pebble Beach, we didn't really have a solid locker room program. So we built $1 million, tent. For the whole locker room player association. And then we tear it back down. And, you know, 15 years later, we build it again. Well, what if we actually worked together and built something permanent that they could use every year? They could use for their PGA Tour events and their Champion Tour events. But for probably $4 million, we could build something permanent, and it would pay for itself in 4 championships. But nobody ever knew we were going to have 4 championships. So it's all about a real investment into making these championships better. And I think both the fans and the players will be the winners of that. Now, at the same time, if you take a typical decade of U.S. Opens, we might have 5 or 6 of these, what we'd call anchor sites, but you're always going to have 4 or 5 non-anchor sites and places that we may not be coming every, you know, 10 to 12 years, but we're still going to be part of U.S. Open. So it's a nice mix between the ones we knew we were going to come to and let's really invest in better, and then leaving a bunch of dates open so we can have some other, you know, I wouldn't call them one-offs, but some others that maybe aren't as regular.
Mike Wann, we know your time is extremely valuable, especially right now. Are you comfortable with all the preparations at the LA Country Club? And could you put a ball in the ground today?
Yeah, we could have put a ball in the ground 2 weeks ago. So, I mean, course-wise, couldn't be better. I mean, they've been a great partner to work with. We've built a small city on their south course, which is always tough for members to see. We built the longest, most expensive bridge in golf over Wilshire Boulevard. Anybody who lives in LA, the concept of a bridge over Wilshire Boulevard was quite an effort. So I want to thank the city of LA and our construction team for that. But anybody's ever been to LACC, you could probably play a major. You just pick the date and just show up and you could play a major that day. But to build the, you know, when you start talking about tens of thousands of people on a golf course over the course of 7 days, it requires requires engineering that becomes more. The golf course itself, this golf course is major, you know, every day of the year. So never had a concern about that.
Well, speaking of major, that's exactly what you are in our eyes. On behalf of Kelly Elbin, it It's your friend Bob Bupka, Mike, saying best of luck. Thank you so much for coming on Musings on Golf. And good luck. Let's have a good one.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate you guys having me on.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
You know, Bob, I don't know Mike Wan personally beyond the time we spent with him on the phone, but he's a pretty sharp guy. Did a tremendous job with the LPGA, and it sounds to me that the United States Golf Association is in very capable hands for a long period of time ahead.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, Mike Wan, I met him a long time ago, even prior to his LPGA days, and Charlie Meacham, the longtime commissioner of the LPGA, told me that when Mike Wan took over, the LPGA was in excellent hands. And Mike, he's a straight shooter. He was very kind to come on. I mean, can you imagine? It's U.S. Open week, and he takes time to come on our show. I mean, we can't appreciate that enough. But a good guy that's doing a good job.
No question. We thank Mike Wan for joining us. Look forward to be back with you, Bob, next week to recap the 123rd U.S. Open. Happy Father's Day, Bob, to you coming this Sunday, to all fathers out there. Enjoy the playing of our national championship. For Musings on Golf, Kelly Elbin signing off. For Bob Bupka, thanks for joining us.